Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So today I want to talk about a major theme in classical Christian thought. The idea that evil is not a real thing or a real property of things, but is instead the lack or privation of goodness. And I say that this is a major theme in classical Christian thought because we can find it articulated in many major Christian thinkers. St. Augustine, probably most famously, St. Thomas Aquinas treats evil this way. Boethius, in his Consolation of Philosophy, has some very poignant words about this this view. So in the material that I'm presenting, we will read just a tiny bit of Boethius and reference St. Thomas Aquinas a little bit. But I want to make clear that this is a sort of distillation of or a synthesis of material we could find in any number of Christian thinkers from the deep past. And by the end, I hope to say something about why the view that we will be presenting maybe doesn't feel as intuitive to us anymore as it did to these great thinkers of the past, but suggest that even if it seems startling or counterintuitive, that there is, in fact, good reason to continue to believe in our own day, as these great thinkers from the past believed, that goodness is the primary thing and evil is only the corruption of goodness. Okay, so I want to begin by framing this in terms of a problem, and you all have the handout. I won't be making explicit reference as we go along, but it'll just sort of naturally track the flow of the talk. So the thought is that God, of course, is essentially good and therefore couldn't make anything that is intrinsically evil. And since there is evil, this seems to pose some sort of challenge for traditional theistic and Christian belief. How is it that there is evil, given what we believe about God? And there are various ways of formulating the problem. Some people, the mid-century British philosopher Mackey, probably most famously, who thought that we could formulate the problem of evil as a logical problem, that there's actually something logically contradictory about God's being all good and all powerful and the existence of evil. More often today, those who take the problem of evil to be a significant challenge to Christian belief focus on what is often called the evidential problem of evil. Not that there's explicit contradiction in what Christians believe about God and the reality of evil, but that the reality of evil provides strong evidence that there isn't such a God as Christians say there is. So a variety of ways of formulating the problem, but that's where we're at. I like to focus on the fact that God's essential goodness predicts, so to speak, that everything that exists is good. And so then the challenge is, since that seems obviously false, what do we make of it? So believing that everything is good and that evil is just the corruption of good, that God could only make good things, we might be tempted to think, as some Christian thinkers of the past have thought, that this world of ours, for all of its imperfection, must be the best of all possible worlds. If God is essentially good and everything that he makes is good, why would there be anything less than perfection in this world? Now, I have long been unmoved by this thought that this is the best of all possible worlds, inspired by St. Thomas's own reflections on this question, which is that anything that God makes is bound to be finite. Finite in any number of ways, but let's say finite in goodness. So each individual creature is finitely good. The totality of all creatures is finitely good. And so then you can run this very intuitive sort of thought, which is that for any finite good, there could be a better. So if this world that God has made is good, but finitely so, then it seems like God could have thought up a better world and have made a better world. But he didn't. But here's the catch. There are any number of finitely good worlds that are better than this world. And for that matter, perhaps any number of finitely good worlds that are worse than this world. So then we need to imagine, so to speak, not meaning any sort of irreverent anthropomorphism, God, so to speak, just picking a good world that expresses his goodness, perhaps not in a uniquely good way, but if there is something conceptually impossible about a best of all possible worlds, then we need not worry, so to speak, that this world isn't better than it is or as good as it could be. I find that a helpful thought anyway. So we're dealing with a world that is finitely good. We shouldn't expect it to be the best of all possible worlds. But golly, sometimes it just feels like things could be better. And even if God can't, even if God can't max out creation, so to speak, shouldn't he have made things just a little better than they are? And the privation theory of evil comes along, I think, in a very helpful way to make us, so to speak, in one important sense, content with what God has done and how God has ordered things. So suppose that we try to think of evil as a kind of property of things. We would have to suppose that that evil is something that we just subjectively sort of project onto things. It's not really something that's in things themselves, but we have various attitudes or feelings or beliefs. So when we call something good or bad, we're not identifying something real in the thing. We're just saying something about our own response to the thing. That would make value in general subjective, and then nothing would be evil in itself. And so God would not be, so to speak, on the hook for having created any evil. Now, that's a non-starter for Christians, I think, to make all values subjective as a way of preserving God's goodness and the goodness of all creation. So then we have to think of evil as something objective in things that are evil, something objective. So what is this objective evil? Objective in the sense that it is what it is, or the way it is, independent of our thinking about it. If we imagine evil as a kind of real thing, that a property that attaches to various subjects, the ones that we recognize as evil, well, then it seems like that positive property, evil, is a real thing in the world. And if God is the creator of everything, if there can't exist anything that does not depend for its existence on God, well, then we'd have this problem. We'd have these positive evil properties that are real things, and only God could have made a thing, and so God makes evil. So I suggest we don't want to think of evil like that, as a kind of value property that attaches to things. So this is where the privation theory of evil comes in. We describe evil as a kind of lack on the model of blindness. We have a way of talking about a person who lacks sight as a person who is blind. So grammatically or morphologically, blindness is a positive word, doesn't include a negation. But we recognize that in calling someone blind, we mean that they are not sighted. So similarly, the idea would be that when we call something bad or evil, even though the grammar doesn't involve a negation, in fact, the reality is that there is some negation, some lack of goodness. But notice that to have a lack in and of itself isn't a bad thing. Okay, so here are two things that can't see. Homer, the Greek epic poet, and this water bottle. This water bottle can't see, and so in that sense is similar to Homer. But here's the important difference, of course, is that Homer, being a human being, is the sort of thing that should see. He has a nature that is sighted. And so although people lose their sight, people's eyes go bad in various ways, even if they still have their sight, we recognize a lack of sight or poor sight in a human being as not merely a lack, the way that a water bottle lacks sight, but as a privation, a sort of lack where there shouldn't be a lack. It's no problem for the water bottle that it doesn't have eyes. But it is a problem for a human being when he or she lacks sight. So that's the analogy, that evil is a lack of goodness where goodness should be. Now, here I want to highlight some idiosyncrasies of English. This came up a little bit last night. You know, we have bad and evil. And evil, both evil and bad, can signify just a sort of general defect, like the apple is bad, the egg has gone bad. But it can also signify distinctively personal defects, you know, moral defects. So when we're dealing with moral badness, we'll often talk about evil or wickedness more often than badness, whereas badness seems to me to be a more generic sort of word. Also, another idiosyncrasy of English that maybe disguises makes it harder to see the intuitiveness of this privation theory, is that when we talk about, when we use adjectives like doing well or doing poorly, the adverbs don't match up, so to speak, with the corresponding nouns and adjectives. And so this can, when you say that something is doing poorly, you know, we all learned in grade school that you can't say badly, but that's what poorly means. So it's badly off. And similarly for doing well, it's doing goodly. So when we talk about a dog or a tree that is sick or diseased, it's not doing well. Right? It's doing badly. But we might say poorly, and so not realize that we're actually attributing badness to the sick dog. Of course, we don't mean that the dog has done anything morally wrong. We don't mean that the dog deserves his sickness or anything like that. It's just that relative to how a dog ought to be, this particular dog isn't measuring up, so to speak. And so in that sense, is doing badly. I think that the greatest difficulty with this privation theory of evil is making sense of it when it comes to human personal defects and moral defects in particular, bad actions, bad thoughts, vices, bad habits. If we really are trying to think of evil as a lack, then what do we make of, you know, having a bad habit? It looks like we have this extra something, you know, a disposition that has been cultivated that inclines us to do bad things. So we need to think about, so to speak, the ontology of bad actions, bad thoughts, and bad habits in order to make sense of this theory of the privation theory of evil as a general theory for all bad things. And remember, what's at stake, so to speak, here is that God is good and therefore can't make anything bad. So whatever is real has to be good. In one of my favorite books, Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy, the poor prisoner Boethius is talking with Lady Philosophy, who is guiding him through many of life's hardest questions, trying to give him answers that will console as he faces his own death. And part of what I love about Lady Philosophy is that she has many kind of startling ways of expressing ideas that were quite familiar in Boethius's own milieu and would have been commonplace, and maybe even so commonplace that they could have been passed over or not noticed, except that Boethius, as the author, has Lady Philosophy often put things in a striking way. So look at what she says here on the handout when she's trying to explain to Boethius that that in fact bad men are weak because they can never get what they truly want, which is happiness, and we can only be happy when we are united with the good. And therefore, bad men being bad can't be happy. So I'll just read this as she goes on to explain. I won't deny that evil men are evil, but I do deny that they exist. For just as you call a corpse a dead man, but not simply a man, so I would say that wicked men are evil, but not concede that they really exist. For a thing exists when it retains its role and preserves its nature, but what falls short of this truly ceases to be, since its being is contained in its nature. But you'll say, evil men can do things. I won't deny it, but their power comes not from strength, but from weakness. So a lot to unpack here, and I won't offer a commentary on every aspect of it. But the striking thing, probably the most striking thing, is that evil men don't exist. We get this analogy. A corpse is a dead human being, and a dead human being is not a human being. A wicked man is supposed to be similarly not a man. What do we make of that? Now, I think that if we offer too literal an interpretation of Lady Philosophy here, then Boethius is saying something absurd. But here's how I read it. And you might not read it the same way, but it's my talk, and here's the point I want to make. That there is something defective about being a wicked man, such that to the extent he is wicked, he doesn't measure up to his human nature. And so to the extent that he's wicked, we can say he is not fully human. Now, in the biological sense, yes, he's a human being. In the a legal sense, yes, he's a human being. If he's a very wicked man who's committed a crime, we might do some things to him against his will. So evil does matter to how we treat people in one important sense, but of course he still has the intrinsic dignity of simply being a human being. But to the extent that he's wicked, he has lost his humanity. So the Boethian program here is to identify the wickedness in a person with what isn't there. So now I'd like to kind of test this out by thinking through these three categories of bad things, or excuse me, bad actions, bad thoughts, and bad habits, and how we can make sense of these as privations of goodness. So, a bad action. So imagine a murder by stabbing. So we imagine the murderer gets really, really angry, has his shiny steel sword. I guess people don't use swords anymore. Knife. And in his rage, attacks the victim and stabs him through the heart, and the person has died. Okay. How is that a privation of evil? Looks like that is a really powerful sort of action that causes a horrible effect in the world. How can we think of that as something that is good, but just lacks some goodness that it should have? So here's what I'd like to do is sort of analyze it together. You know, we have the anger in the man. Anger is sort of a response to something viewed as threatening or odious. The fact that we're capable of anger, given the irascible appetite that we've been given by God, that capability to become angry is not as such bad. The sharpness of the steel, the hardness of the steel, that's not bad. The fact that the man is strong enough to wield the knife so as to, you know, sufficient strength to go through a man's heart, right? That's good that he's strong. Even the fact that the poor victim's flesh is susceptible to being stabbed. I mean, if our flesh weren't sufficiently soft, we wouldn't be able to move around in the ways that we do. So that we wouldn't be able to perform surgeries as needed or emergency C-sections when we need to deliver the child. Or so the vulnerability of the flesh, that too is not an intrinsically bad thing. We have the maybe something like the intention to kill on the man's part, the murderer's part. Is that as such a bad thing? I don't know. You know, St. Michael goes to war against the fallen angels. There's something good about martial valor in the right context. Of course, here in the murder, that's not being, so the intent to kill is not appropriately directed. The point is that as we analyze the action, what's going on, say, in the man's head, what the man is feeling, the murder weapon, the action, the actual action of stabbing, and then the parting of the flesh and the bleeding out, all of these things are good. It's the combination of them that is the wrong thing, is where they go bad. So we have something like a failure of the man to use his capacity for anger in a way that promotes the good. We have the lack of justice of the man's intention and, of course, the action. But everything else about the action is good. So I think that, let that be a sort of example, you know, as you think through on your own, and maybe some of these can come up in Q&A. When you think about a bad action, you know, the strategy should be, let's analyze its parts, see what is good in any sort of action, even a bad action, and then identify the badness with something that's not there, that should be there. I think we could say similar things about bad thoughts, but I want to focus on habits. Let's sort of skip to habits. This one has bothered me, actually, personally, for a long time. And I think I just recently satisfied myself of an answer. I'll just throw it out there, and then we can see what you make of it. In the broad Thomistic Aristotelian tradition, habits are thought of as a certain kind of thing, entity, you know, something that we acquire through our practices. Some of our habits are goods, we call them virtues. Some of our habits are bad, we call those vices. Other habits, of course, are infused directly by God, faith, hope, and charity. So now focus on a bad habit or a vice. If we're thinking of that as a thing, well, this seems to be a challenge to the privation theory of evil, because it's a bad habit. It's the sort of thing in the will or in the soul that reliably inclines one to do bad things. So how could that thing be intrinsically good? I think that one thing that we can say about this is to connect vice to its root, which is weakness. You know, to vitiate is to weaken. That's what vice is. This sort of comes through in our like a bench vice, you know, if you're in a shop, or vice grip. You know, so if you have a vice, you have something that is weakening you. But now that's not quite enough just observing that, because, well, what is that thing that is weakening you? We could say that a weak human being has a privation of some strength, that he, moral strength, strength of character that he ought to have. But what is that thing in him that is causing that weakness? Are we to imagine a vice as a kind of cancer of the soul, like a positive thing? No. Instead, I think that we should think of vices as, I'm going to suggest a couple models here. Something like an atrophy. You know, if you have atrophied muscles, we can think of the weakness, the ensuing weakness of the person, not as the presence of something, but as the absence of, you know, the muscle has failed to be cultivated. I had broke my femur once, my tibia once in high school, and I had a full leg cast for a long time. And when it finally came off, my leg had shrunk. You know, the muscle had, I don't know, worn out. So I had atrophied. And I remember the doctor describing this, you know, that it would take a while and don't try to run right away. So I had a weak muscle. There wasn't anything there causing the weakness. It was just, it had become weak. So think of vice, perhaps. You can cultivate your own weakness, moral weakness, by consistently doing bad things. Maybe even by consistently failing to do good things, you can develop a vice. Also, perhaps we can think of vice as the sort of failure of reason to control various appetites of a human being. So here we think of, you know, reason as having a normatively a leading role over the whole person. So as our appetites point us in different directions and don't really care, so to speak, about the goodness of the whole person, reason is supposed to be that control center that keeps our appetites coordinated and in check. And if there's consistent failure of application of rationality to our appetites, then we will be vicious. But we aren't identifying something in the will. We're just identifying a failure of reason to control. So there too, so again, just to sum up this section, we have these distinctively personal challenges to the privation of theory of evil, bad actions, bad thoughts, and bad habits. But I think that there is a way of analyzing these that is consistent with the broader claim that evil, even human moral evil, is a privation of goodness. Okay. How much time do we have?
10 minutes.
Yeah, good. here's another sort of challenge to the privation theory of evil, one that I think is real. It hasn't personally exercised me as much as the others I've just mentioned. But one sort of objection would be that, well, fine, maybe we can think of the ontology of evil as a privation instead of as something positive. But how does this solve the original problem that we proposed? We said that God is essentially good and therefore can't create anything bad. Technically, the privation theory of evil would solve that problem, but maybe not in a satisfying way. Because after all, why would God allow for there to be these privations? And I think that there are two good responses here. One is the classical free will defense. So the idea is that we're thinking about the problem of evil. We should take a kind of pluralistic approach. There's no single sort of response that all on its own philosophically takes care of whatever is supposed to be problematic about the problem of evil. So the privation theory of evil, I think, is an important component of a Christian response to the problem. But we can't forget other traditional ways of thinking through this problem. And the bad exercise of human free will, and perhaps also angelic free will, I think goes a long way to explaining God's allowance of evil. It's consistent with the privation theory of evil, but is a separate sort of claim. Distinctively moral badness is a result of the free bad decisions of created persons. So the fault of such badness accrues to created persons and not to God. If we ask why in God's providence does he allow people to make bad decisions, ultimately that is mysterious, but as we heard last night, God is committed to ensuring that there is no final evil, that God brings good out of even very bad actions that his creatures have done. And the other thought is something that I have long admired in St. Thomas. He says, in willing the preservation of the natural order, he wills some things to be naturally corrupted. So here we're not focusing on distinctively moral evil, but what we might think of as sort of the general condition of things suffering in various ways, like when they get eaten by other animals. For St. Thomas and his tradition, what God intends in creation primarily is the good of the whole and not the good of any particular parts of the whole. God is interested in establishing a good order, a unity of order, as he says several times. So in that order, given that God has gratuitously made things like us, things like the various kinds of creatures that we know about in the world, and intends to get all of these things into some sort of order, a harmonious universe, well, you, given the intent to create these kinds of things, it follows that that some things are going to thrive at the expense of other things. What's bad for the compost is good for the worms. The worms make the soil or enrich the soil. The grass takes the nutrients from the soil, breaking it down. The cows eat the grass, the humans eat the cows, that sort of thing. Things thrive at the expense of other things. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It's certainly not a positive entity. So if we're thinking through why does God allow natural evil, even if we concede that evil is just the privation of goodness, I think it is helpful to think of God as in his providence arranging primarily for the good of the whole order, and then allowing it to follow as a consequence that the thriving of some things comes at the expense of other things. If things weren't that way, if God were somehow obligated, if he were going to make a world at all, to make a world in which nothing thrived at the expense of other things, well, God would have to make totally different kinds of things than he in fact has made. But God has made us, God has made the giraffes, the horses, the lions, the oak trees, and it's just great that these things are all here. So supplementing the privation theory of evil is a robust understanding of God as willing an order of nature rather than just the discrete thriving of different kinds of things. And secondarily, that moral badness really is a result of bad decisions on the part of created persons and not divine persons. So supplementing the privation theory of evil, I think that we can offer a cogent sort of response to the problem of evil formulated as a kind of challenge against the goodness of God. Yes, God in fact does create things that are good and only creates good things. All of the evil that we recognize, to the extent that we really are recognizing evil or badness, we're identifying a lack of goodness where goodness should be. And I find this strong assertion of the primacy of goodness over evil to be a profoundly hopeful sort of philosophical view. So, you know, as philosophers, we can think kind of abstractly. It can sound sort of arid that we're trying to come up with a theory that solves a certain kind of logical problem. But just as the doctor, in the moment that he's performing cancer surgery, shouldn't be actively feeling the full existential weight of the cancer diagnosis on the patient and on the patient's family, needs to just sort of get down to business, even if the doctor really does care, right? And so performs the arid, cool, calm surgery precisely because he cares so deeply. So too, as philosophers, we can sometimes sound dry and detached, but it's precisely because we care so much about these issues that we try to think hard about them and think well about them. And so just to sort of show my own sort of heart card here, that I really do find this to be profoundly hopeful, and I hope you do too. So let's talk about it, you know, take questions, objections, and let's keep thinking together.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.